fact of all of the ecological interests that we have today, and nature has played a tremendous part in it, why, it's a sort of a stupid question, isn't it? But honestly, think it over. Is nature necessary? And when we conclude, we'll conclude a little bit like that motion picture that the Lutheran Church put out some years ago called Question 7. How many saw that picture? While it ends, it leaves you up in the air. You're hanging there. You have to make your own decision how the outcome of this thing is. And I hope, in a sense, to leave you hanging in the air a little bit on this pertinent question of the day, namely, is nature necessary? Now, perhaps you have asked in your life, why is it that we've got mosquitoes, rattlesnakes, poison oak or poison ivy? Maybe you've asked that, maybe you haven't. If you haven't, why? I think most of us have asked these questions, haven't we? Why we've got these things? I took a group of boys up Copper Basin during the summer when the deer flies were in their prime. And all they did was swatted away and moaned and groaned and cursed these little creatures. And so I told them, don't hurt my little flies. And they looked at me. Well, at first thought I was joking, and then they thought, well, maybe we're out with some kind of a nut. And they just couldn't understand that. But then when they saw me swat a few, why, then they realized that I was sort of pulling their leg. And then when I told them, what would you do if you were a mama fly and you would see that your 1,000,000th baby didn't come home tonight? And so they proceeded, therefore, to swat most vigorously. Well, why can't we kill off everything and live by ourselves with far more room in this world, which we call a planet here? Soon we'll be able to synthesize our food, and we won't even need the room that is necessary for agriculture. Admittedly, some would want to go to this extreme, but who would insist that everything in nature serves some easily defined utility in this man's world? But on the other hand, no man wants termites in his house. No man wants grizzly bears in his backyard. Right? Aren't you glad you got no grizzly bears in your backyard? Man's history has long been a learning process to live more fully and in the greater numbers by taking advantage of those forms of life that he thinks have no reality or no necessity whatsoever, and then by disposing of them and quietly getting rid of them. In fact, we can ask, therefore, is nature in itself truly necessary? Wouldn't it be better if the last mosquito, horsefly, deerfly, termite, tarantula, rattlesnake would be exterminated? Wouldn't it be better if our forests, which are so vulnerable to lightning and man, would be replaced by man-planted trees, groves, all in stately rows? I rather enjoyed the forests in the Rhineland in Germany. Every one of those trees was planted by a man. Every single one was cared for. Kind of interesting. And yet there was something missing about the forest and the Rhine. May I relate the place where I was brought up in the western side of Wisconsin, the Mississippi River, in La Crosse, Wisconsin? We have the bluffs that are geologically formed on either side of the river, a beautiful portion of the Midwest. And when I was about in the eighth grade, Father bought a 10-acre farm. He didn't know beans about farming. He did this so his boys would be under the disciplines of milking cows and stuff like that. And on this farm, I grew up and heard things and saw things that I no longer see or hear. We used to have Bob White whistling on the 10 acres there. How many have ever heard of Bob White? In the northern states. How many are hearing them yet? Where do you hear them?
Around Sacred Heart, Minnesota.
Is that right?
Sorry?
Yeah.
There's some down at Lucerne.
Down at Lucerne.
Yeah.
And they sing Bob, Bob White, Bob, Bob White.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't heard those for 30 years in this particular area of Wisconsin. Then we used to have the whippoorwill. Sing in the summertime in the woods. And I haven't heard one of those for 30 years. They are around, I know, but this is in an area, in a wooded area, that is no longer exploited by marginal farms that there used to be when I was a boy, but all of these things have disappeared. This is the same thing, a goat sucker. Then we had the chimney swifts who would go and dive into the big greenhouse chimney every night in our chimney in our farmhouse that didn't have any heat in it or anything. And they lived in there. And I haven't seen those. They fly like little cigar butts up in the sky and they make noise and dive right down. They are gone in this particular area. Is our world to be a gadget-filled world soon, and would it... crowding out all of these sort of little organisms that once were and no longer are there. Below Kings Canyon in the Kern River, above the Kern River in California, is a place called Mineral King. How many have heard anything about this place recently? Just a few of you. You Californians certainly should know about it. The Disney Corporation is going to develop this area into a winter resort, not like Disneyland, but they're going to have a fantastic hotel up there, not one but many ski lifts going way up into the alpine areas, and the peaks go up to about 11,000 feet there. And of all things, in the end of the drainage of the minerals of the can't remember the name of that, the Kiwa River, the South Fork, looking over a gap called Farewell Gap, they're going to have a 9-hole golf course at 8,500 feet in elevation. Disney Corporation's got holes in their head. Then they're going to have a fantastic area of parking lots. Imagine the problem of erosion, moving boulders and everything else. We were at Holden Lake this afternoon, and that would be take every bit of the meadows around Holden Lake and putting them in blacktop. And Disney Corporation is getting by with it. And the government will have to go and condemn Forest Service land and National Park land and spend millions in getting a road up there. Man is growing apart from the world that nurtured him. And when I was a boy in high school, we did some memorization, something that isn't done very much anymore, and I think maybe some of you older people here maybe memorized Wordsworth, "The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers, little we see in nature that is ours." Did any of you memorize that? It didn't hurt us, did it, to get that in our head through mental discipline, but somehow it stuck with me. Little do we see in nature that is ours. Hooray for Disneyland and all of that. Our loss of nature is enhanced by the lack of instruction in our homes and in our schools. I think that all of us should have a child every 5 years until you're 90 or so, and then you can follow these kids as they go through our secular life and education. And you can have your eyes open a little bit on curriculum. We were married 8.5 years before we had a child. And believe you me, when Gretchen got to go to kindergarten, I knew her teachers from, I guess, clear on to her 8th grade. And I knew what stuff she was having in school. And it fascinated me. And in the 5th grade, she came home with a biology book. Boy, was it a dandy. This was in the state of California. I don't know how their textbooks are made. We have a director of school who is a little rambunctious and outspoken, Max Rafferty. Maybe some of you know him, and maybe some of you dislike him. And he has a lot of loyal friends, too. Say, he lost out on the nomination for Republican senator, didn't he? Well, I voted for him, so we all have our privileges in America and choices in that. But anyway, this fifth grade biology book in California was a dilly. It was profusely illustrated. It had every one of the biological science listed: anthropology, ichthyology, dendrology, animalology, and ornithology, birds, and everything you wanted to have. And it was beautifully done. Fifth grader. So I remarked with a great deal of excitement to Greg, "How do you like it?" And she said, "Yuck." A fifth grader pouring the whole works down her craw. This is a problem that we have in some of this business of teaching nature, particularly in the biological fields. And I think much of our teaching is oversimplified, or it is just simply a deluge poured upon them. For 25 years, I've had a bug collection, or I should say an insect collection. I don't know how many I have with entomology pins stuck through their abdomen, or their thorax, rather, and in a bug-proof bug box. And I don't know how many hundreds of children I have entertained in church. That's where I keep my bugs. That is the six-legged insects. And how many kiddies come crawling into the office or walking the office, and, "Pastor, let's see your bugs." And so we have a delightful hour sometime on bugs. Why don't we have a little more of this in biology? They're receptive. Is Mark here? He is not here. A classmate of his who just graduated from PLU, I can remember seeing him crawling on hands and knees up the stairs saying, "Pastor, let me see your spiders." I just, "Spiders, fooey, I got just bugs. Spiders got 8 legs, bugs got 6 legs. Well, this is a problem that we have. High school and college courses often begin with biochemistry. And they've even had, yes, in junior high school, Karen had it. And they rarely begin with any enthusiasm, namely the relationship of man with all of his environment, particularly in the natural world. There's nothing wrong with biochemistry. It's one of the glamour courses today. But it is once or twice removed from the world of our experience. What do we mean by nature? If we mean that which is wholly out of contact with human beings, then of course it isn't necessary. It isn't even pertinent to mankind. There may be some beautiful jungle on some planet way out into space we wouldn't know a thing about. We'll never know a thing about it. It's absolutely unnecessary to us then, therefore, isn't it? We don't care to define nature in this particular sense, but rather to digest the elements in the world that we do not directly manipulate. And there is the difficulty. Because man is a manipulator, and his mere presence soon brings out alterations, doesn't it? Did you notice the picture? I did talk quite a bit last night about that picture where Carol is speaking to this Luther League group in Holden Lake with that beautiful background of the glacier and the falls coming down. Well, I looked at that very site this afternoon again. When Carol and the group left, I stayed there. This was in early June, and I looked to see how clean it was. There was no litter or anything, but it just disturbed me a little bit to see what 23 Luther Leaguer feet, as well as the director of Holden Willie Village Big Feet, did to that little area along the shore of Holden Lake with all of those spring flowers trying to get out of the ground. They'd been under snow all year, and there they were, tromped and trampled. Then a few weeks later, Gwynella and Don and your garage guys camped up there.
Not me.
Doug and Don. Not you. I know you wouldn't camp up there. But anyway, I told them to camp on the other side of the meadow. And a week or so later, I went to see where they camped. You have no problem finding where people have camped in a virgin area. All of the grasses were trampled down flat. And this afternoon, while I looked around to see what our famous deer hunters have been doing up there. One, they shot a buck and they cleaned him 15 feet from the camp table. There's meat and gristle and guts and everything. They were too lazy to haul down their rope on which they raised the carcass up, so I brought that home. It's a good rope. Then I looked for a box that the hike house has up there with containing pots and pans, and only one party used them this summer, a girl, two girls and a boy from Superior, Wisconsin. And they found the box, they saw it was locked, and they locked it again and brought the key back. And since that time, somebody has knocked the lock off, and there the box is, looted. Now, who in the world would want to do that? This is man, the great manipulator. And boy, does he manipulate in nature. Many feel that generous samples of natural communities need to be preserved and kept relatively inviolate and be open to just a few people. And that's the philosophy behind the Wilderness Act that was created by Congress in 1964. But here's a real problem in knowing how small it is to be, or how limited it is to be, or how much human traffic it can bear without losing its integrity. This is a wilderness area right from the ballpark on. Did you know that? This is a wilderness area created in 1964. The last 2 weeks in August, we have kept an accurate count of just the lunches and the food we put out for overnight by the guests and the staff of Holden Village. How many people did we fix grub for in 2 weeks, in the last 2 weeks of August? Some of you guess, or you, I maybe some of you know, don't say it.
35.
200.
75.
How much?
75.
75. You're all off. 400 people in 2 weeks, and there are others that we didn't make lunch for.
Is it overnight, you think?
No. About 20% of them would be overnight. There would be other meals. But we're just taking people here. 400 people. That's a lot of human erosion on the wilderness area. It's not on blacktop or on concrete. This is on good old Mother Earth. And so here you have this problem: how remote should a wilderness area be, how limited should it be, and all of that. But then we have pressure of growing populations, and of course these areas then will come up for grabs if there are more people and more people, and then minerals and all of the exploitation of natural resources. There have been so many eloquent pleas for wilderness areas that little time has been devoted to them. We've had one of the first, I would say Henry Thoreau in America, then John Muir out here in the West Coast. We have a man on the Supreme Court who's a justice who's got quite a few shenanigans as far as I'm concerned with some things, but he's quite an outdoor man. Let me quote from our friend Douglas. "The endless wonder and excitement of nature's flair for individuality rather than conformity." I think that's kind of cute. Nature's individuality rather than conformity. A remote canyon in the Rockies, or for that matter a clump of grass in some city park, can serve a tremendous purpose for people, much more than LSD, and even give you a much better trip. No side effects. And you went to Heart Lake today and Holden Lake today. You really were on a trip, weren't you? You really were on a trip, weren't you? That is, if you had your feet off the trail and weren't watching the pebbles and that stuff. The peaks were fantastic today. The cloud effect was good. The lighting was perfect. The rain coming in, everything you had. You were on a real trip. And I feel so sorry for those who have to have the artificial aids. But the ease of travel now puts a variety of relatively unaltered natural areas at the ready disposal of everyone. Because people are really traveling, aren't they? Henry Truman was a man who closed up the Quetico Provincial Park in southern Ontario from seaplanes. And the butter and egg men from Chicago would fly up there and get into a remote area in 30 minutes. catch a bushel basket of walleye pike, and then fly back to Chicago. I remember 20-some years ago of a plane going in there before the season opened, and it crashed somewhere in northern Minnesota with a bushel basket of walleye pike in the plane. It didn't burn up. And I was so nasty in my mind that I secretly was happy that the thing crashed. I don't know if people were killed or not, but that's how mean that I can get on some of these things. Was it spring, my neighbor boy came over and said, their birthday party, they went to the movie, and what'd you see? Well, we saw that Alaska Safari that was filmed last year. I don't know when it was filmed. And he said, ooh, friendo, it was good. And I said, what'd you see? No, I saw people fly up there in the Arctic region in planes and shoot a polar bear, and I flipped my lid. I started preaching to him and hollering and screaming, and the poor guy ran home scared, you know. And this movie really got panned for pulling off that junk. The poor polar bear deliberately shot, what for? To entertain somebody in a flea house, called a movie. I read of a man, a zoologist has this in the book, who spent $15,000 killing a bighorn sheep in Wyoming, flying to the Atlas Mountains in North Africa in Algiers and getting a sheep there, flying to Mount McKinley and shooting a doll sheep. Now he has three heads in his den or his room or office to collect moths at the expense of $15,000. We will ask this man, is nature really necessary? We had a guest here at Holden who sat there, we spent quite a few moments talking with him, who is a professional man, apparently has money, and he took a trip last year for 6 weeks in British Columbia with a colleague where they had two riding horses, two pack animals, two guides in order to shoot a mountain goat and a mountain sheep. And he justified this to me, maybe somebody might know this man, but he justified this as well. Anyway, Ernie, the sheep are eaten by wolverines and by wolves. So that meant that he could shoot a couple of them. I'm so happy they didn't get a goat, they just got a sheep. Is nature really necessary? And now we got the snowmobile. Let me read that first sentence there. The ease of travel now puts a variety of relatively unaltered natural areas at the ready disposal of everyone. And that the word disposal has a double meaning. For the more we use these areas, the more the natural properties will disappear. The nature of the biosphere is largely determined by evolution, that is, by the types of organisms that have adapted themselves to a specific temperature range, rainfall, and the soil types, and of course adapted each other to the anthroposphere, that's man, fitting in man's need. And here's where the real question pops again. Is nature therefore necessary? How do we build our cities, and how do we fill the space between them, are problems of immediate concern to all of us. Do we wish our environments to be entirely artificial and managed, or shall we allow room for squirrels and ospreys and for crickets? What shall we save and what shall we destroy? Aldous Huxley, in that book, This Brave New World, and by the way, Carol was the guy who introduced me to that some years ago. How many have read that, This Brave New World? It's a satire. There they had perfect comfort and security that had been achieved by children being bred in test tubes and all that. All but the savage in the book. He cherished the right to be lousy. He wanted to be lousy. Although I have no affection for a louse. But did you know not many years ago every palace in the country where kings and queens lived had bedbugs? Did you know not many years ago every inn and the wayside where people traveled, or they didn't call motels, were notorious for their bedbugs? Did you know not many years ago the Pullman trains had to fight bedbugs, and every time anybody came to my house who slept on a sleeper, Mother sure examined our that bedroom where our guest slept. We don't have bed bugs, do we? Well, maybe we're losing something, but don't knock DDT too much.
They still have bed bugs in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
They do. I'm going to make a trip there just to see these fellas. Well, in my backyard, I have lizards. I'm not particularly fond of them. I let a porcupine waddle ahead of me in the trail up Honeymoon Hike, and he owned the whole trail. In fact, I had to turn around and come back. I have backed away from rattlesnakes who have warned me, and I had to recross a stream that I crossed with a great deal of difficulty. And I wouldn't mind so much if we'd have a few grizzly bears left in the state of California.
I have snakes in my garden.
You've got snakes in your garden.
They
bless you.
They eat all my bugs.
Oh, they eat all your bugs. Well, I believe the strongest argument for keeping as much of the natural world alive is the human need for variety and individuality and the challenge of endeavoring to understand a non-human world. I believe, too, that immersion in a world of trees and flowers and wild creatures is needed to nourish human attributes that are in such short supply today, namely awe and compassion and reflection. And the brotherhood we talk about is kind of rarely achieved nowadays, except in a superficial level. May I give a little illustration? A couple of years ago, we went to some anniversary in a former parish near San Francisco. And so I was going to give Pearl a real treat, and we'd take a motel in San Francisco and spend a day there. And whoever had been to San Francisco lately, I've never stayed in there any place, but boy, you have to have a reservation a month ahead of time. So we got some flea house somewhere on Market Street just by luck. I was going to blow in take her to a show, a stage play, and I got lost up there on Hyde and Trail or something like that. It was raining, and we started climbing the hills and wound up in Fisherman's Wharf, and I took her in that old factory that's turned out into a junk shop. What do they call it?
Place?
The Import Mart. And oh boy, she was happy. It only cost me a couple bucks. And we get back. So the next day she wanted to go to 19th Avenue at the market, the shopping area.
Stonestown.
And who's in there? What big store is there? Macy's and all the rest of them in there, you know. Another hawk shop outfit. So we agreed that you could diddle around there all morning, and I would go to Golden Gate Park, and I would work that morning the Arboretum that I had never really worked. That's a fantastic park. So I race like mad to the Arboretum, run into the place, puff and pant, and look at the trees from South America, the trees from Australia and New Zealand, and race over. I was going to get that whole park in. Then I stopped to a place where they had dwarf conifers, and I noticed one man with a newspaper. Have you been to Golden Gate Park?
Yeah.
There are a lot of queer people in there. I go in there often. Yeah, but it's a park. I think it's one of the world's finest parks. And pretty soon a covey of quail walk through there. They're very tame along the coast, and the California coastal quail have the straight feather out of their head, and the mountain one have the golf club feather, or is it the other way around? I think the coast has got the golf club on the head, the little crescent. And here they were walking through there, and this man was standing up, and we start talking. And then he suggested, over here there's another rare group of dwarf stone pine, and so we looked at those. And he says, back over here is an area where they have wild crabapple orchard, about 30, 40 varieties. And then he says, have you seen the blind people's garden? No. And so we went over there, and here's a raised garden on a wall like this, and all of the flowers are fragrant, and in braille on metal placards, the blind people can read and identify as well as smell and feel. And I was just thrilled to pieces that this park or this city, and it's a sinful city, would have such sensitivity for one group of people. Then we hurried over to the Japanese area, and then we exchanged cards. And here, he was a Russian Jew, a scientist who perfected perfumes. I was a Lutheran pastor and a German. You can see here all our spiritually and ethnically and everything else. But there was one thing we had a mutuality, a oneness in common. And before I knew it was 12 o'clock, he had to go home to his mom, and I had to go to my mama. And we regretted that we had mamas. And we bowed and shook hands and everything. And I could have met that man 10,000 times in the streets of San Francisco, and he'd have meant beans to me. But here, as we've had the sensitivity of awe and reflection and even compassion expressed in the Arboretum of the Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, I think that human qualities grow best in an environment that transcends the human, that allows room for the stretching of minds and feelings. On the state and national scene, we admit that parks are growing in number, but our affluence is growing faster. Public campgrounds in every city, years ago we used to have that, didn't we? You could travel from coast to coast and every town had a public campground. Yeah. And you pitched your tent. Then they gave way to the tourist cabins, $2 a night. And dishes were furnished, and then they'd steal them so they had no more dishes. And then we got motels, and boy, what flop houses they are. And now we got trailer courts and all of that stuff. And then we got more and more people. The rangers in our natural parks are nothing but traffic directors. Spend very little time on research, very little time on giving occasional fireside chat. And only by basic ecological research in the parks can we begin to answer the relationship between recreation and conservation. Every other year we used to camp in Bowman Lake in the northwest corner of Glacier National Park. 38 miles of discouraging roads in order to get there, a very small campground, and a certain class of people would go there. Practically every weekend, Montana people would haul on a trailer, a boat with the motor over the transom, and that is a long haul. Some would come 200 miles clear over the Rockies in order to scoot up and down Bowman Lake. Ask them, where you been? I don't know. And then beer cans would float on this, and the director of this place, who was the dean of men at Ripon College in Wisconsin, had been there 20 years, I said, what do you think of this garbage? And he says, boy, why don't you write to the supervisor? This is the problem that we have in our national land. We have a tendency to make mountain country into parks because they are little fit for agriculture or industrial values. But I'm glad that there are places for man's enjoyment that we should perhaps look at, namely the unexploited lands of the valleys and of the plains and of the seashores. But with this affluence that we've got, not only do we have all of these people traveling, but now we've got these trail bikes. And John caught a guy with a trail bike up above the ballpark here this summer. And they poured the gas out of his tank, and the poor guy had to push it down to Lucerne. But he could coast half the way. I told John, you goofed there. You should have tore it apart and made him pack it out on his back. As the anthroposphere continues to encroach in the biosphere, the museums will more and more assume the role of guardians of the world's treasures. Just as one may now visit certain museums to see a stuffed passenger pigeon, a sad visage of the hordes that once filled the skies not many decades ago, he may someday visit the museum to see other creatures that we take for granted right in the here and the now. And as a boy, I used to talk to Mr. Ebner, who was about 80 years old when I was a lad, who told me when he was a young fellow, he'd hold his rifle up in the air and shoot when the passenger pigeons came by and a dozen would fall down out of the sky. Personally, I believe they would become extinct anyway because they were just too prolific, and we have too much agricultural land today. We no longer have the great auk or the heath hen and the California grizzly bear, and our condor is rapidly going there also. We should not think of museums as just as dead zoos, but more and more they're becoming concerned not only with preserving dead specimens, but also with a concern for the living things. Nests and songs of birds' behavior is recorded in living film, and some have field stations or natural areas where plants and animals are studied as parts of the natural communities. And so you see, our museums are forced to have an interest in this pertinent question, which is our title. But in today's world of technology, where money means very little, and I will demonstrate, I have lived 10 years nearby Vandenberg Air Force Base, where they shoot missiles on the Pacific Test Range. Thank goodness this is going down a little bit, but let me defend missiles a little bit. I was all for it, and I still am all for it. How much did it cost us to go to the moon? Billions and billions. How much did it cost us in experimentation? Billions and billions. It's costing Russia the same thing. I'm so glad that these two power countries are wasting their money on that instead of war. And the byproducts that we have had from the missile industry have been fantastic in the field of physics and electronics and medicine. And they have really been fantastic. I'll admit there's an awful lot of waste of money. The man across the street from us is shipped here by his firm from Cape Kennedy. And when they ship them, they ship all their furniture, and if they got nuts and bolts and hardware and cement in the garage, the movers put that in too, they get paid for it, the government is paying for it, and then he comes up with a great big boat from here to the wall over there with a motor in the back and a trailer on it all the way to California, clear across the country. We taxpayers pay for that. He works 6 months, and they ship him back to Cape Canaveral again, and all of that garbage just goes all the way back again. Money means nothing, not one bit. When the United States Department of Agriculture maintains a team of taxonomists at Smithsonian Institute, and they are in charge of the fantastic number of insects submitted for identification, usually in connection with research and in control of pest species, in 30 years, this staff at Smithsonian has been cut from 25 people to 21. You can think of the thousands and the thousands in the electronic missile business. And at the same time, the amount of time spent on basic research declined, this is just in the field of entomology, from 63% to 21%, just in basic research. And this all in spite of the fact that the insect problems are acutely on the increase. So the fire ant comes from South America, and we got a crash program how to get rid of it. Nobody even knows how the lousy little beast lives. Is nature necessary? A midge dancing up in the alpine thicket at the head of Holden Lake might be a rather important key to understanding, namely the rat in the city dump, or an elephant trampling about the jungle. In 1890, an entomologist by the name of Peck wrote, this is a century and a half, "These diligent and faithful servants of nature, namely insects, as Linnaeus calls them, are perpetually engaged in destroying all that is dead and of checking the increase of all that is living in the vegetable world. In the execution of the task assigned to them, they often frustrate the designs and subvert the arrangements of man, thus constraining him to attend to objects which are generally deemed beneath his notice, and obliging him to feel how effective in the smallest is the smallest instrument in the hand of omnipotence." It's ironic that these words are true today as they were a century and a half ago. And the insect's complex interrelationship with plants and pollination, putting the brakes on the overwhelming number of plant feeders that wouldn't be for the insects, why we would just be overwhelmed by insects. You see, they prey upon one another. The decomposition of plant tissue and the animal material all are the work of these little creatures that we are forced to study, but we certainly aren't doing enough. And you, any young fellows here, you want a field, man alive, become a specialist in entomology, just in wasps or yellow jackets. Little Glenn Collins will appreciate that. Four of them chomped on his head. And When I wrote this in June, I have written, I didn't read Morris's book, The Naked Ape. I have to revise that because I have read it since, because the Lutheran student movement was here and they bought all kinds of books to buy. And you remember you were here, you could buy The Naked Ape, you could buy Desmond's How to Burn and Kill a Golden State, and you could buy that emotional book by Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and many of you love her and everything. But be a little more balanced when you read these things. But this guy Morris, and he made a fortune on that book, Naked Ape. It was more or less sexuality than it was anything about biology. But anyway, if man at one time was a primate or an ape or anything and lost his hair and became naked and walked in his hind legs and invented pollution, radiation, population explosion and wars and everything, it was the most stupid thing he ever did. Because he's the only ape who's got hemorrhoids and piles. Apes don't have them. Nor do chimpanzees and monkeys. Well, we better know nature. The earth is a good place to live. We appreciate it more and more as we explore the moon and the planets, right? When you saw the pictures of the moon, man, did you appreciate your backyard? Or even your city dump? It's a good place to live. And if man should ever have another home, it's almost unimaginable. We had better respect this planet. And I conclude with a quotation from a man who ran twice as a Democratic nominee for presidency, and Eisenhower beat him both times, and I didn't vote for this man. But yet there was something about Adlai Stevenson. My brother voted for him, and he was called an egghead because he was of the intellectual type. Politically, I think he was a dead duck, but he did have a lot of good things in his head. And here's something that he said that I think deserves to be etched out in some log here or some granite rock. Adlai Stevenson, we travel together, passengers on a little spaceship, dependent on its vulnerable reservoir of air and soil. Isn't that good? All committed for our safety to its security and its peace, preserved from annihilation only by the care, the work, and I will say, the love we give our fragile craft, this planet. Isn't that beautifully put? Beautifully put. Now I'm through. We hang it all up in the air. But I'd like to make just a few observations and then you can kick it around. One.
Can you give a definition to ecology?
Well, ecology is namely the relationship of the environments of all living organisms on life. I would say this would might be definition. And when
it, from the Greek, it means house?
No, that's economy. Koinonia, a good housekeeper.
Ecology.
All right, Greek here.
Ecology.
Ecology.
It comes from
it goes to a good housekeeper? Yeah, just like economy would be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. This fits in here with some random things that I'm going to say. One, what is the solution to the problem? Let's take pollution and that in ecology. I'm very, very pessimistic. I hate to say it, but I'm awfully, awfully pessimistic. Let me just give you a few things. Man is quite a manipulator, I mentioned. Well, just one thing. Up here in the mine is a building, the first one you come to when you take the mine hike, where, is that where the scientists were, where the core samples were and all that stuff? Yeah. For 10 years, this stuff was practically left alone and undisturbed. This summer, sometime the latter part of this summer, some goons have gone there and pulled the trays out with all of these cores, and there must be a couple of dozen on the floor. All of the dust samples and little bags are strewn all over there. Why? Why? Then you got that next building where you got old toilets and stuff in there, and they're beating them to death, throwing them on the wall, busting things. Why? I ask you why.
Vandalism.
This is housekeeping, isn't it? Housekeeping. Next. This is a community, and it's one of the finest communities you can possibly find, bar none. We are away from all of the filth and smog and garbage and everything, with the exception up in here. But I think I have picked up 20,000 cigarette butts this summer. And right in this room, we had a man lecturing on, namely, solution and its pollution. And he was smoking cigarettes, and then he mentioned this. He says, this is a form of pollution, too. And so I interrupted him, and I says, yeah, what do you do with that butt? He says, I'll show you what. And he stood up and demonstrated to us how to strip a cigarette like they did in the army and then take the filter and put it in his pocket. It was a beautiful demonstration. I have never seen anybody do that in this Holden village. And I think right now you can look under the altar in our center there, and there is a cigarette butt that when I took communion Sunday night, there it was on the chancel. I'm terribly pessimistic, folks, on a housekeeper in ecology and in nature. Terribly pessimistic. Some people we know are downright filthy. And the only answer, I think, friends, is this, that in Isaiah we have this suffering servant of Jesus Christ. He was a suffering servant. And this is what you and I have to be in this world of ecology, and pick up the filth, the deer guts up at Holden Lake. I didn't get around to do it. I was so cold this afternoon, right by the campfire. The garbage and the filth that you have. I think this is the only answer to it, but there are not enough of us, are there? There are not enough of us.
Right now, the only one smoking in the village are those of us who are around all the time, and yet, it's been here and there, and by the time we've been out on the street, never that fresh, no.
Yeah. They have a perfect right to do this. And I nobody's smoking here. If they would be, I would like to ask people just to help me out a little bit. You carry the pack around with you and matches and everything, and you don't throw that away. It costs you quite a bit of money. But then there all of a sudden becomes such a terrible disdain for the leftovers, and you don't think a thing about that, when all you have to do is throw it in the fireplace or eat the finger when you're in your pocket or something.
Were you here the night when they were talking on air pollution?
Yeah.
And four of the main fellows that were talking about
were
smoking.
Yeah, like mad. Yeah. Well, that's just one of those things in here. Then the disdain that we have, like John had a fire down below Lucerne, 20 men fighting, a deer hunters built a fort. They should know better, shouldn't they? They've been reading the papers of thousands and thousands of acres burning. But here you have this business of poor housekeepers. I'm glad you brought that word up, ecology.
Well, I heard a speaker talk on ecology.
Yeah.
He said it means the Greek.
It's an interesting thing. It's a terribly interesting thing. But I'm just pessimistic in this sense, because you find there in that place in Romans, namely, for the whole creation is awaiting for redemption, not only man, but also this good earth, this good planet. It must too be redeemed. And when that lion will sit down and eat with a calf, and when the little baby will put his hand on the viper's den and the rattlesnake pit and everything, when all of these things of death and sorrow and pain are gone, there'll be no pollution, there'll be no rubbish. It will be then paradise. And this is what we have to look forward to. Well, now you take it away. I'm not...
You didn't mention litter on the highway. The practically everybody is getting very conscious of that, though. Yeah. Carrying litter bags and cars. Yeah.
That only lasted for 6 weeks.
But that litter bag is all right in the car if the windows were fixed, but they could never be opened.
I think everybody now that I know of carries a litter bag in their car.
And another thing
is that on the parking lot of the grocery store.
What?
Where do they empty their litter bags?
They empty them in the filling stations in the garbage can.
They should.
On a parking lot in a grocery store. I mean, that's where they empty it.
Have you ever stopped and asked that person?
How many have read Stuart Udall's articles? He's very concerned of this pollution. Yeah. And recently I heard a broadcast on television that in the East Coast, in New York, they're running all the garbage dumps, and that the rich people are bringing their furniture cast-offs and dumping them on the roadside, and that there's one gravel pit that the man wants to haul gravel from, but people are passing over on a bridge and they're dumping their garbage down in there. And he said they cannot dump it in there until he's through using it for a gravel pit. And